We've invited a very dear friend of mine, Shomit Ghosh. We've been friends for a god-awful number of years, Shomit. Is it, what, 20 years or something?
20 years, I think, yeah.
Shomit is a partner at Onset Ventures and a very successful, accomplished entrepreneurial executive in the Silicon Valley startup scene. You know, there are very few people who have gone through the number of successes that Shomit has gone through, including several IPOs, Broad Vision, Tumbleweed. These were, you know, big success stories of the first wave of the internet. And today Shomit is at Onset Ventures, and he works with a lot of entrepreneurs on a very, at a very hands-on level. And that's really a skill set that you don't find as easily amongst people who are on the venture side of the equation. So welcome, Shomit. It's a great pleasure to have you. You're one of the most thoughtful people in the industry, and it's always great to brainstorm with you. So today we brainstorm publicly. Something we do often privately, we're going to do that publicly today.
Thank you very much for such a kind introduction. I am unworthy.
And very modest, always. So let's start with this topic of bootstrapping using a paycheck. You know, when I kind of grew up in this Silicon Valley Kool-Aid drinking environment, right? Arrived here very young and jumped right into the venture business and as an entrepreneur, and everybody had all these maxims that, oh, you have to quit your job and otherwise you're not a serious entrepreneur, and all of these, you know, sayings. And yeah. So now, of course, it's a lot of years have passed since I've gathered a bit of wisdom, and this particular truism, so to speak, or myth that you cannot start a company while you have, or start a significant company while you have a full-time job, I have come to the conclusion is a myth. Tell me what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I always felt that that was the case. Viscerally, that seemed to be the case, but I had never seen any actual validation of it. And then as you and I talked about earlier, there was a HBR piece, I don't know, 4 months ago,
yep,
that statistically proved that you're better off actually starting a company while you're still employed rather than just jumping in all in. And no doubt that's because when you do go all in, you put yourself under a lot of stress. It's like having to make decisions without being able to deliberate on them. And so maybe the quality of your decision-making suffers. And I think that as long as you're not not compromising your confidentiality and intellectual property agreements with your existing employer, there should be no trouble actually starting your next company while you're still employed with your past company.
And as I've covered in the book, actually, at least in our industry, in the technology industry, the trend clearly is that employers want to support entrepreneurial employees. So if you are actually tinkering with something, with an idea, with an innovation, and you want your employer to support you, the chances of the employer actually supporting you in that endeavor is quite high. Don't you agree?
I agree completely, because the employer knows that they're better off having you innovate within the company and keep those ideas within the company, ideally,
right,
and so they would be supportive of it. So, yeah, I think so, because one of the things that larger, more established companies probably lack today is that spirit of innovation. So I think employers, the savvy ones, know to foster that kind of environment.
I don't know if you talked about this. We are doing a lot of projects, actually, in the corporate incubation area with corporate partners to foster intrapreneurship development right now. So,
that's right. Yeah, and even here in Silicon Valley, if you think about it, you know, we're the font of creativity and all these great huge startups that are doing wonderful things. But if you look at it, even Facebook is acquiring WhatsApp and Oculus VR, and Google is acquiring YouTube, et cetera. So even these hot, innovative startups who become successful are still acquiring from without. Because it's often not sufficient to try and grow from within. There's so much creativity outside your company walls.
Well, and there's no process. I think there is, you know, it's very ad hoc. You try to do innovation inside the company, it's kind of ad hoc. Only recently have I seen definitive efforts inside companies to try to create processes that have, you know, that offer real structure to the innovation process. Of course, there's, you know, the most famous of these is the Google 20% flexible time, which is a total failure, by the way. And yeah. Google has also abandoned that because that is a complete unstructured structure, and that has gone nowhere. But I think there is a lot more interesting and a lot more structured innovation processes that are better processes that are being experimented with.
Right, exactly. And certainly corporations are trying to foster innovation within the company, within their existing employees, as well as you've probably seen, there's an increased amount of venture investing that are being done by these large corporations, again, specifically because they realize that there is so much innovation going on, and if they don't get involved actively, they'll find themselves left by the wayside because the pace of innovation is so quick nowadays.
So on that, you know, as an extension of that theme, I want to follow up with a question about another myth that Silicon Valley has propagated internationally. Nowadays, you know, whatever Silicon Valley thinks, the whole world starts to think. And some of it is very dangerous because what Silicon Valley is thinking, if you sit in South Africa and start thinking the same thing without any of the infrastructure that Silicon Valley has, you are bound to fail.
Right.
And then one of these myths is go big or go home.
Yeah.
I don't think innovation happens this way. Tell me what you're thinking on this topic.
Yeah, no, and unfortunately, I think that what happens is that the companies that are successful by going big are the ones that get highlighted. I think WhatsApp is a good example. I think over the past 2 years, they lost something like $200 million.
Yeah.
And had been the recipient of over $60 million in financing.
Right.
And had revenues, but not material revenues. And here they are, a $20 billion acquisition. So what is the case that's highlighted to everyone? It's WhatsApp. And everyone thinks, yes, well, that's the secret to success, to go big, and then you can become a large exit like that. But the fact of the matter is, as you and I have learned and seen over the years, is that literally 99.99% of those companies don't have exits such as that. And I guess maybe the analogy would be, yeah, there are people who've gotten rich by buying lottery tickets, but that's not an employment strategy that, you know, my job is going to be to go out and buy lottery tickets. So you're much better off pursuing the fundamentals of building a real business, one that's valued by customers, has a repeatable sales model, has growing revenue, much better off doing that than chasing the siren song of going big.
Do you think are the opportunities of building really interesting ventures right now? What's your, you know, investment thesis, so to speak?
Boy, yeah, we could talk for a long time about this. So we actually had decided 10 years ago, well before the advent of the term big data, we decided 10 years ago that hardware is commoditized and it's free, software is commoditized, it's free, bandwidth is commoditized, it's free. So you can't make money selling any of those. But if all of those things become free, what happens? Well, data gets produced in profusion. So for the past 10 years, our investing philosophy has been and continues to be that it's all about the data. So we continue to focus our investing in areas that are really based on extracting the semantics of data or providing the semantics for this massive data that we're seeing. And particularly in the area of big data and using data for business effects, we think we've just entered it's like the early industrial age in that, as far as we're concerned. It's like we've just invented the first, you know, steam engine. So the future that lies before us is pretty vast. And the companies that get the most interest from us are companies that are focused on that. So one of the things, for example, that we've been looking at recently is using, you know, big data for security purposes to do continuous authentication. Because, you know, continuous authentication would help solve the problems caused by you know, firewalls getting pierced and credentials getting compromised. But continuous authentication requires doing continuous big data analytics. So in every area in which we look, I've looked at a couple of deals which are medical informatics, and it's using large-scale data to inform physician decisions on not only things like prescription, but also even the kinds of tests you should be prescribing for the conditions that are being presented. Nowadays, it turns out physicians either over-prescribe or under-prescribe diagnostic tests, and may actually prescribe tests at facilities which are more expensive than other facilities, unknowingly. And one can employ data to help those physicians prescribe the correct tests. Same thing for pharmaceuticals. There's something like 15,000 prescribable pharmaceuticals, and physicians being humans like you or I, they have no way of knowing what are the specifics of 15,000 different pharmaceuticals. So they end up doing the same thing that you and I as patients would be doing, which would be reading the back of the bottle. And when it comes to pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical prescriptions, one size does not fit all, as you can imagine. And you know, certain pharmaceuticals, if overprescribed, can be toxic, or if underprescribed, can lose their efficacy, leading to further downstream effects. So there are teams out there today that are employing big data for pharmacology. So there's kind of no end of opportunities that we see here. So we're very excited about the developments that are out there.
Do you watch Farid Zakaria's Sunday morning GPS show?
You know, I've seen it in passing, but generally not. I'm out riding my bike at that time, so yeah, unfortunately not.
So it's a very good show, and last week actually he did us the whole show on innovation, and one of his guests was Vinod Khosla.
Mm-hmm.
And Vinod made a comment which I actually agree with, and then kind of segues from your about medical informatics and, you know, how doctors prescribe, how doctors even diagnose or, you know, decide on treatment. If you apply big data to patient scenarios, at any given scenario, the computer, the software, if it's designed properly, is much more capable of coming up with better solutions, better analysis, better prognosis, better treatment predictions, prescriptions than a human doctor. So Vinod's thesis is that doctors will be replaced by, let's call it artificial intelligence. And I happen to agree with that.
Yeah, I happen to agree with that as well. And I think IBM has richly demonstrated this with Watson and using Watson as a diagnostician quite effectively. So I completely agree with that. I think perhaps where physicians will still play a key role is that human beings react quite well to the moral and emotional support that another individual will give them, just in the manner that they engage with them. So it might be that the physician is delivering the diagnosis and the therapeutic treatment plan, but the diagnosis has been informed to a large part by something like Watson or an AI-based approach.
Yeah. Which then, you know, comes to the next, you know, big leap in futuristic discussions is that how far is big data, machine learning, expert systems, AI in general going to go? Where is it taking us? And of course, this week, the media is abuzz, and I have also written a piece yesterday about on this topic about Stephen Hawking's comment that if we let AI go to its full potential, the species is going to become extinct. And Elon Musk also has sent out a caution on this subject. We're probably not talking in the next 20-year or 40-year time frame, but we are probably in the very shockingly, actually, within striking distance of some extraordinary levels of automation, which renders right. human beings with basically no vocations, no, you know, maybe there's 0.1% of human beings who have something to do, and then the rest of the people have nothing to do, no profession, no livelihood. Zombies? Where are we going?
I think that's a great technological and also sociological question, and I don't pretend to be wise enough to know the answers there. And I find the topic wholly engaging, although I'll admit that I haven't read enough about it as yet. So I'm speaking largely from ignorance. So I look forward to reading your piece. I think that would be great. So I'll do that as soon as I get back into the office. Yeah, I think there's a real danger there. And you know, if you think about AI run amok, it's the Terminator movie. You know, Skynet has become self-aware and is now dominating mankind. And certainly something like that could happen where you have a malevolent artificial intelligence. And maybe that's a threat at some point, maybe not. I think probably the biggest threat is artificial intelligence inadvertently harming us. So for example, if you, this is just an example off the top of my head, and maybe there's a better example, but if you had an AI system which was asked to do something as benign as optimize the yield from a wheat field, that seems pretty benign, right? For the good of mankind, et cetera. But you teach the system, here's what you need to do to make sure that the wheat field is as productive as possible. And one morning, the AI system detects that there's a family having a picnic on the wheat field. What is it going to do? So the family having a picnic on the wheat field is no different than an invasive crop of locusts as far as the AI is concerned. And so the family is, you know, eliminated. Whereas you and I as human beings would not do something like that. It's okay, yeah, go ahead and have your picnic. But the AI system is doing exactly what it was programmed to do, which is to optimize the yield in the wheat field. So I think that might be the bigger threat, more immediate threat, the unintended consequences of programming something to do something really well. And if we humans insert ourselves into that somehow accidentally, the system doesn't know us. It knows us from a locus, frankly, and away we go.
Yeah. You know, the other part of this equation, which is what I stressed on in my article, I didn't go into the threat part, which Elon Musk has actually talked about a lot more along the lines of what you're talking about, of the unintended consequences or even AI running amok in an evil way, sort of. I've dealt with more the economic question of if people, you know, their whole the pace at which professions are getting automated or will get automated once machine learning really kicks in gear, which, as you said, right now we're still at just scratching the surface, right? Machine
yeah.
learning is really at the absolute beginning of its manifestation into industry. We're probably talking about a 50-year cycle, but machine learning being machine learning has incredibly fast capacity to become very powerful. So in the next 50 years, I'm positive that we're going to see machine learning penetrating every aspect of the human endeavor. And if that really starts to take over professions and eliminate or shrink, you know, professions basically in huge numbers, then we are left with a very, very large population on welfare. And that is not economically a sustainable situation.
Right. I agree. Right. So I think we started to see the beginnings of this already. So you've certainly got robotics and manufacturing. And I can foresee that within, you know, the next 10 years, we're going to see self-driving cars, if you can, perhaps obsoleting taxi drivers.
Right.
So we've just begun there. And as we talked about, you know, if you even look at professions that require high amounts of training, like being a physician, well, maybe 80% of your job can be done by a Watson-like system. You're only there to perform the procedure and to deliver the diagnosis. That's it. So instead of working 8 hours a day, you're working only 2 hours a day. But perhaps the flip side of that was instead of only seeing, you know, 20 patients, maybe you can see 80 patients during the course of the day. So, you know, perhaps there's some performance improvements there, but yeah, I can see that there's going to be a lot of jobs that are eliminated, and I don't see what jobs might be coming to replace those lost jobs.
I think the positive opportunity there, as you said, is that maybe a lot more patients will be able to access high-quality medicine because of this, you know, in rural areas and where today high-quality medical support is not as available. I think that is a possible positive outcome of this. Just scalability because of the machine availability, but in the longer term, there could be elimination and may not compute.
Right.
What about in the medium term? So let's say we are in 2014, about to cross over into 2015. What are you thinking in terms of the end of the decade? By the end of the decade, what are the major changes we can expect to see?
I think we've already started to see them, but in the area of data-driven applications, we scratch the surface, but we're starting to see actually penetration adoption there. So I've seen a few different teams that have come out of medical schools that are using large-scale data to actually solve medical problems, which I think has been pretty exciting. There's an article in, I think, of NPR about a week ago about using big data to inform how to write music, better music that's more engaging and more compelling. And New York Times about a week ago, there's an article on big data as applied to agriculture. So we're starting to see more and more of this, and we're going to see, I think, more of penetration of large-scale data models into things that are done either by human intuition alone today or done by only using small amounts of data. And I think the growth of unstructured data in particular is what's going to drive this. I think heretofore, all of our data-driven applications have been driven off relatively small amounts of data sitting in structured databases. And I think that day has passed. I think the future is really going to be based on being data-driven through unstructured data.
And what are you thinking in terms of where we go in the in the next 6 years on in terms of this whole bubbly environment that we are dealing with? These valuations are ridiculous. You talked about WhatsApp. WhatsApp is just representative of a larger phenomenon going on in Silicon Valley where fundamentals don't seem to matter anymore.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's a little bit of a difference. Certainly, I believe that there is a bubble that's building nowadays, but I think the bubble is building at a couple of ends. One is at the high end, where you have companies like Uber or WhatsApp that are benefiting from large valuations because people see them as being world-changing in some way. And then there's also a bubble at the angel end. There's a very large number of companies that are being angel-funded nowadays. The kinds of companies that we see, the Series A and Series B, Series C companies, haven't been as affected. We've seen valuations creep up a little bit, but they haven't been as affected. And I think maybe that's because we tend to focus on boring things like B2B software and infrastructure software, and they don't have the same cachet as the mobile application. But I think what we saw 12, 13 years ago when the first dot-com bubble burst was a lot of companies that had gone public that didn't merit having gone public, so companies like WebVan and Tech.com, et cetera, and they died probably the deserved death. And so that was a post-ITO bubble that we did, an ITO and post-ITO bubble. Nowadays, it seems that mostly the bubble that we see has to do with really early stage seed stage companies, angel funded companies, and there's a very large number of that. As you probably know, the University of New Hampshire tracks this data on an annual basis, and I think last year there were over 70,000 new companies funded by angels, which is a stunningly large number, because if you think about the number of companies that go on to get Series A funding from VCs, that's roughly, and it's been constant for many years, there's roughly about 1,000 companies a year. So you see 70,000 companies or more every year getting angel funding, but only about 1,000 moving on to get Series A funding from VCs.
So I think the bubble, as you say, is on that end, and also it's in the late stage company end also, where, if you have actually done, if you have been able to prove your thesis and something interesting is happening, then at a pre-IPO stage, the valuations are going completely berserk.
Right.
And I just don't see how that kind of berserk valuations will translate in the public market. They just can't. The public market is not going to tolerate that kind of valuation.
Right. No, I don't think so, because public market is really driven by things like, price to earnings ratios and things like that. So perhaps
the
those valuations will come down.
Right now.
Excuse me?
The public market is not as frothy.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. So, I believe that's right. I think once companies do go public, the valuations will get dampened as they go out and get judged relative to other public companies. no doubt some premium will still be paid on the kind of strategic perception of a company. A company like Uber will always command that strategic valuation multiple, but in the end, you know, markets are driven by profits and earnings. So that's what the final analysis will come down to.
So folks listening today, please take one very important statistic away from this session. 70,000 companies got angel financing, and you know, just about 1,000 got Series A venture financing. So you're playing in a very, you know, poor odds game, and you have to, if you want to be a serious entrepreneur, a successful entrepreneur, you have to have persistence, and you have to have the stomach to bootstrap two sufficient levels of validation and success such that you're not dependent on venture capital. And of course, you know, VCs actually love to come to the rescue of victory. So if you can prove that you can be successful, there will be VCs who will want to come to your rescue at that point, right?
And as you said a little bit earlier, Shuma, it's really about building substantive value. You can't just think, I'm going to get big fast and be a huge success. It's not going to happen. It's just like, you know, I can go out and buy lottery tickets, but I'm not going to win, I can guarantee. So as you mentioned at the outset, really focus on building substantive value in your business. And at the University of New Hampshire, they have a Center for Venture Research, and they publish this data quarterly and annually, the number of angel-funded companies every year. Again, in 2013, the number was over 70,000. NVCA has the companion statistic of how many companies get venture financing at Series A, and that's generally around 1,000 year in, year out, you know, sometimes a little bit more or a little bit less. But if you just marry those two statistics together, and you can see kind of the daunting odds you're facing, which brings you back to build value, because as you say, VCs are happy to ride to the rescue of victory. So build that substantial value, and those VCs will happily leap in and jump on your coattail.
Well, Shumit, thank you for being here, and I know you have another meeting, so we'll continue privately, I'm sure, over lunch sometime.
Great. And
look forward
to it. Thank you so much. It's been an honor to be here. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.